Good evening, everybody. Let's begin this evening's review with the motivation. So yesterday was sort of the starting day of a month-long time of celebration and entertainment and having a good time in samsara, at least in America and a lot of the world, as we come into the holiday season, starting with Thanksgiving yesterday and Black Friday today in America. And, you know, the Buddha taught many, many times that there's absolutely nothing wrong with pleasure. We can enjoy it. But during this season in particular, and many other times in our life as well, we forget that happiness comes from our own side. That we forget that happiness is not in the food. The happiness is not in the good company, the friends, the family, the football games, the parades, the walks in the woods, the shopping, the Christmas lights. But during this season, it sure seems like happiness is coming from outside of ourselves. There's something quite mesmerizing about samsara this time of year. And even though we have been up and down through samsara in every which way, in every realm of existence, we still find it alluring. And what finds it alluring? This very strong sense of self that seeks to be gratified, to be reassured, to be comforted. And all these samsaric pleasures, because we get confused and think that all the happiness is coming from their side, just makes that self appear even more concrete as it searches for happiness within those objects of the desire realm. So tonight we're going to, as we go through the middle scope, we're going to challenge those assertions of where we think happiness lies and who's experiencing that happiness. Because samsara is nothing but an impermanent phenomenon. Bodies and minds under the control of afflictions and karma, changing moment by moment, arising, ceasing, passing away. And that there's nothing in samsara to really hold on to, because in the next moment it ceases. And so as Venerable says, since it's going to change anyway, how about if we set our minds in a virtuous direction as we undergo the changes of samsara? And we do that by cultivating an aspiration to make our lives meaningful, to really see the defects of cyclic existence, and to have a strong determination to be free of these perpetual hallucinations of where happiness comes from, and to generate a strong wish for liberation, not just for ourselves, but for everyone, to become Buddhas as quickly as we can to achieve this goal, so that we can really free ourselves once and for all from this mesmerizing cycle that leaves us bereft, confused, hopeless, and instead set our sights for the long-term goal of awakening, for our own ultimate peace and the ultimate peace of all beings. So let's do a little bit of exploring and challenging these assumptions about what we think samsara brings for us tonight. Such a big head. Yes, the holidays are upon us. So we're continuing with the middle scope. And today, Stephen used a word to describe this topic. He said it's a really sobering topic because the Buddha really lays it out quite clearly on how we need to look at our situation here in samsara, what it's all about. And, you know, when I really get honest with myself, if I really understood very deeply what samsara was all about, I would say, you know, who in their right mind would want to stick around here? We have these bodies that get old and sick and die. We have these minds that are continually under the control of afflictions and karma. And we have so much confusion. And we've been reborn countless times in this state. So it is a really sobering topic, you know, and I think, you know, Venerable has said that we in the West have a very strong resistance to thinking about the defects of cyclic existence, what we've got going here. And so, you know, even if we do just a little bit, we just slowly keep digesting it, we keep thinking about it, you know, chewing on it, looking at our lives to see if what the Buddha has said about what's really going on here in samsara, if it's really true. And that we have to really look at it in relationship to our own lives. You know, are we infatuated with cyclic existence? It's been going on forever. You'd think we would have gotten tired of it already. But there's this darkness of ignorance that brings a kind of amnesia to our minds. So that we keep forgetting how disappointing it can be, how disheartening it can be, how dissatisfying it can be, how painful it can be. And so we just keep spinning around in it. So part of what the middle scope does is it sort of pieces all these threads about what the defects of cyclic existence really are and how we cycle through it to get some sense that this is the reality of the situation. It's nothing less than this. And it's done in very clear and direct terms. And once again, Venerable says, this is not supposed to depress us. This is supposed to really enliven and really charge our life with meaning and purpose and to really start to grow our determination to be free. So tonight we're going to continue to look at the middle scope, where our ignorance and afflictions, where they take us. So last week, Venerable Shuni did a great review on the root afflictions, how they wreak havoc on our lives. So we had a list of those. And what was very interesting, and also the idea that if we don't subdue them, what happens is then we end up creating a whole bunch of negative karma. And then at the time of death, that karma ripens, and we're off and running into yet another rebirth. So we did an inventory of the disadvantages of cyclic existence last week, and looking over her review last week, it was very interesting for me to note that we were really pretty sharp on the uptake on what exactly the disadvantages of afflictions are. We could rattle them off really, really quickly on what happens to our minds. We could rattle off very, very quickly what the antidotes are. But then I said, well, you know, Sampke, do you really take steps to confronting them? Do you really see the pain that they cause and the suffering that your afflictions cause? And I can really, and do you have any interest in cutting them off at the pass? So I've got it all in my head. I've got the Lama Min there. I know what they are. I know what the antidotes are. But when push comes to shove in the course of the day, when they start arising, how much determination do I have? How much commitment do I have to do something about them? And I watch myself just let them take over. And so that's what I really want to somehow connect myself to, that this is serious business here. And tonight we're going to see how those afflictions create the karma. And then at the time of death, how just it causes so much confusion. And then, of course, we're going into another rebirth. We know what to do, but I don't do it. I look at my relationships, so when my mind is under the control of afflictions, what happens to my relationships? When I'm under the control of my anger or my jealousy or my hurt feelings, what happens to my relationship to others? I mean, are we lovable when we're under our afflictions? Are we trustworthy? Are we kind? Are we forgiving? Are we understanding? No. When we're under their control or out of control, we have so much suffering and so much discontent. So it's almost like what we most deeply want is to connect and have these virtuous states of mind. When we're under the control of afflictions, they just harm everything across the board. It's not just isolated incidences. It just colors our whole experience of our life. So what we want to do is we want to tie the threads together to see the fundamental ignorance that drives this whole cycle, to see, due to the misunderstanding of how we exist, those afflictions arise in defense of that self that doesn't exist, to protect that self. And then under the control of those afflictions, then we start creating very strong negative karma. And that at the time of death, those seeds ripen. And so the cycle is been going on forever. And we need to see how those pieces connect and where we can start cutting those threads. And how they determine where we go from here and from here in the present to our future lives, and to try to get some energy around looking at this a little bit more clearly. And one of the things that has come up in this review this past week is the dangerous situation that we will put ourselves in by not taking care of these afflictions as soon as they arise, is the increased familiarity and habituation. And we're going to see later on at the time of death how these habituated afflictive states of mind really set courses into motion that really determine where we're going to be reborn. And so the most dangerous aspect of these afflictions is that when we get habituated to them being in our minds, I mean, since beginningless time, we've been struggling with them. We have been incredibly familiarized with them. And if we don't understand the dangers or not try to purify them or subdue them, we just live our life not only under the influence, but at the time of death where we are at our most vulnerable, they're going to be there and we won't have much say. So now when we have some lucidity of mind, some clarity, some courage, some wisdom, this is where we've really got to address them. Because this is an extremely dangerous. I'm getting more in confident about how much danger we are setting ourselves up for if we don't start working on our afflictions now. We've got this precious human life and we have our wits about us. And at the time of death, these negative emotions and afflictions just don't disappear because they have been so habituated in our minds that during the course of our dying, we just feel so much regret and so much remorse that we haven't dealt with them sooner because they're just taking over. And that our deepest spiritual aims have been thwarted and that our longing for liberation isn't going to happen. So we really have to understand how precious our opportunity is right now to look at the defects of cyclic existence and how dangerous these afflictions are. And to reflect keenly on their drawbacks so that whenever they arise, it says, one has come, I see it, got it. And apply the antidotes to be so vigilant about them. And last week when Venerable Chuni talked about the factors that cause the arisal of them, this is another piece that's extremely important on understanding our minds and giving us some tools, is that we went through those factors, which maybe we can just go over real quickly right now on what they are. We can see the places in our lives where we are at the most vulnerable, when we are most greatly influenced by the desire realm that we live in. So what do we have as far as the factors that can bring these afflictions into our minds? What do we have? What's the first? If you can name them, if we can do them in order, great. What's the first one?
The latencies,
the predispositions, the ones that we've created in previous lives that haven't ripened yet under the control of afflictions and karma. So those potentials are in there. Okay, second one?
Contact.
So any of these objects that just sort of stir us up, we have to be really aware of what those are. They could be people, they could be situations, they could be objects. Third one?
Habits. Detrimental influence.
Detrimental influence. All those friends and family, those bad friends, or the people that, in wanting them to be in our life, sometimes we really compromise our truest values and our own integrity. We love them, but they don't seem to really help us to farther our progress along the path and to really fulfill our spiritual aims. They tend to become detrimental to our relationship to our spiritual path. Next one, how about big powerful one here? Yeah, the verbal stimuli, the social media. We've seen that happen in spades this year. That can get our mind thinking on a totally different track of where we want it to go. Next one. Habits. Yeah, this is once again familiarity with these afflictive states of mind. All they need is a little bit of water, a little bit of sunshine, a little bit of cooperative conditions, a little bit of familiarity, and there they are. And then the last one. Thinking, getting it going, starting the little wheel turning, just ruminating, proliferating, creating all sorts of dramas and stories, and just enhancing and really bringing those afflictions even stronger into our minds. So I find that this honest self-reflection of where we are the most vulnerable, I think really helps us to give our minds some protection on where we probably shouldn't go, where we need to be very, very careful. I mean, these things all fuel our toolbox building. We have to really see where we can use the things in the Lamrimin and the Dharma to really help us to counteract these afflictions. So the first outline tonight that we're going to be working on is identifying the karma to be accumulated. And Venerable taught a lot on karma when she did the initial scope, so I'm not going to get into a lot of this tonight because she's done a whole bunch of talking on karma. But I did want to sit a little bit because this is hugely related to what happens at the time of death with these afflictions and karma that have been placed in our mind streams. So just very simply to talk about what this intention, this karma is, the definition of that and the different types of karma that we can create here in the desire realm. Okay, so first we have a primary mind. And then there are mental factors that accompany this primary mind. There are five of them, the omnipresent ones that are with this primary mind all the time, which are
feeling,
contact,
attention,
discrimination. Okay, so these are with our primary mind all the time. And the intention, which is this particular mental factor, directs the mind towards whatever object it is focusing on. So this mental karma is also called karma, intention karma, and that the physical and verbal karmas that are motivated by this intention karma are called intended karma because they are sort of the outcome. This is where that intention karma is putting its focus, and that this intention karma can be under the influence of mental factors, either virtuous or non-virtuous. So this intention can be influenced by anger, it can be influenced by love, and as a result, then it finds its object and then engages it in a certain way, according to whatever mental factor is arising accompanying it. So as a result, we either have this virtuous karma or we have the non-virtuous karma. And these are the two kind of karmas that are found particularly in the minds of those of us in the desire realm. There is an invariable karma, which is found in beings that are in the form and formless realms. So the non-virtuous karmas, created under both types of ignorance. So they're created under the ignorance that in regards to the ultimate nature of reality and also the ignorance in regard to karma and its effects. So that's how we create the non-virtuous karma. Our minds are under the control of those as well as an afflicted state of mind. The virtuous karma, which can be, is having a virtuous intention accompanied by, let's say, compassion, which will bring a higher rebirth, even though it's still polluted because it's under the control of ignorance that doesn't understand the ultimate nature of reality, it is not influenced by the ignorance regarding karma and its effects because it's a virtuous state of mind. And then the invariable polluted karma, virtuous karma is in the minds of beings that are being reborn in the form and formless realms. But we don't have immovable, invariable karma in the desire realm.
We can create it here with levels of
right, right. It only ripens in the particular meditative absorption that we've created
right,
a karma in the desire room. But the mind that experiences it is in the formless room. Okay, so then the next topic is how is this karma accumulated? So what? There's two types of karma. What kind of karmas do we have that determine?
Is it meritorious and unmeritorious?
No. The two that at the time of death.
Well, contaminated and uncontaminated. I mean, how many were?
Oh, well, Geshe Zhoba says two kinds. It's either the throwing karma.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The ones that bring rebirth or influence the rebirth. There's the throwing or the projecting karma, which is the one that pretty much determines what kind of rebirth that we're going to have. And then the completing or the actualizing karma, which is kind of the watering of the seed, the one that basically sets up our conditions that we have once we're reborn. So I wanted to go into Geshe Zopa because I find there's so much about how, what kind of karmas and what beings create what type of karmas. And I didn't want to get into a lot of this, but I have just some little high points on what he describes and how these different karmas are created, just to get a little bit of clarity. There's a lot in here, and I didn't want to spend a lot of the evening on this contaminated and projecting and completing karma and who does what. But I wanted to share a few of them. They're very nice little sections on giving us some idea which beings create which type of karmas. Okay, so we have the projecting karma and we have the completing karma. The projecting determining the particular type of rebirth, and then the completing karma or the actualizing karma, which basically is completes the karma, what type of environment, maybe what type of body we have, where we were born, things like that. Okay, so when a person attains the Arya level, the direct realization of emptiness, he or she no longer creates any new projecting karma. Okay, so that's the greatest relief, one of the great reliefs when we realize emptiness directly, is that we no longer are creating these throwing karmas. Now, although some Aryas may be born again in the desire realm or the upper realms, the projecting karma for those rebirths was accumulated before they attained the Arya state. So during all these countless previous lives, prior to their realizations, they've accumulated lots of causes for all kinds of future rebirths. But once they achieve the Arya level, they do not create any new instances of projecting karma. They can create completing karma, which matures and brings to fruition previously accumulated seeds to be reborn in cyclic existence. So once you attain the path of seeing, no more projecting karma is created. Now, for us ordinary folks, from the supreme mundane level of the path of preparation and below, all of us folks are still accumulating projecting karma that projects samsaric life. We're still under the power of afflicted ignorance, the view of the personal identity. And so we create non-virtuous karma such as killing, where we're born in the lower realms. When we perform virtuous actions in the desire realm, like keeping precepts or giving, we create meritorious karma. When we cultivate single-pointed concentration, we create immovable karma. Thank you, Venerable Chinni, that is correct for sure. These are all contaminated karmas. They are actions rooted in ignorance and the impulse to gratify and satisfy the immediate needs of the self that does not exist in the way it is conceived. So even our virtuous karma in this life while we're ordinary beings is contaminated. But there is hope. And Geshe Zopa says it this way. The point made here is that these contaminated virtuous actions are essentially very favorable attributes. Their nature is to be an antidote to cyclic existence. Nonetheless, they do function as supporting causes that in association with previously accumulated projecting karma lead to future rebirths to the higher realms of cyclic existence. Because they have this samsara-producing aspect, they belong to the truth of the cause. The most important thing to understand that even though you have not yet obtained the path of seeing, the Arya stage, you must apply your energy and effort to developing this thought of renunciation and the wisdom realizing emptiness. These practices will lead you to the Arya stage, even though they are considered part of the truth of the cause of suffering. So even though the virtue we create in cyclic existence is contaminated, it's considered part of the truth of the cause of suffering, we're still heading in the right direction. Because I've always been somewhat disheartened by that information. Okay, I think that was the only thing I wanted to say about that. So it's just talking about, you know, as ordinary beings, this is what we have. Once we reach the path of seeing, then we've got some, we're going to be picking up steam, picking up a little bit more momentum as far as not having these, we no longer have these lower rebirths. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about the different kinds of karma. So we doing okay so far? So once again, these are all being placed in our mind streams, countless since beginningless time, and that's what we continually have to remember, because we're going to be going into, right now, the factors of death, how our life ends. And I found this really kind of fascinating. And it, what it did for me is it made me recognize that karma is not, our lives are not like this linear number line, that there's so many things going on that can determine how we live our life, what happens to us during our life, and why our life ends. I mean, I didn't recognize that we have a lot of things going on here, not just, you know, I live till I'm supposed to live, until the causes for me cease to exist, I can live to be as old as I want. I mean, I had this sort of romantic notion that as long as I kept myself out of trouble, I was going to live to be an old lady. Well, there's a few more things going on here. So the first possible way in which our life ends, it's called the exhaustion of a lifespan. So when we take a rebirth, there is a certain karmic lifespan originally intended by the projecting karma that comes with us in that rebirth. All right, so that certain karmic lifespan that has been accumulated in previous lives comes along with that throwing karma when we take, let's say, this precious human life we've had, this life. When we were put into this rebirth, not only did the throwing karma set us in this rebirth with all of the completing karma, but then there's this karmic lifespan that has come along. So one of the reasons we die is that the karma for us to be alive simply finishes. That's what we had when we came in. So sometimes you see babies dying in the womb. Sometimes you see people living to be, what, 110? Flossie Dickey died 110 years old today. And that all is pretty much determined by this karmic lifespan that came with the throwing karma in this life. Another reason is, and this is where I was quite, I've taken merit a little bit more seriously, is that it's another reason that our life ends is the exhaustion of merit. We may have a karmic lifespan to live a long time, but then maybe midway through that life, the merit to have food, shelter, clothing, and medicine runs out. Maybe we have the karma to be alive, but the merit to have the means to keep us alive has been exhausted. So we may not have the merit to receive food, clothing, shelter, medicine, because the merit to sustain us has run out. So there's deprivation like hunger, cold, poverty. So merit supports the requisites that keep us alive. So that's something that when I think about accumulating merit, one of its primary functions is to help us to sustain these bodies and to sustain us as we're going through these lives that this karmic lifespan has projected for us. The third one is death from failure to avoid danger or unfortunate circumstances due to carelessness or putting ourselves in danger. So there are 9 different causes. So do folks have any idea what those 9 causes are? A lot of them are around food. Does anybody remember what they are? I can list them. One is sex, yes. One is sex.
Overeating is one of
them. Overeating.
Something
poisonous or unsuitable for your system. Okay, so overeating, eating something poisonous or unsuitable for your system. And the overeating, Venerable said, she wasn't sure whether this meant you overate once and you died or you're constantly overeating so that you create things like high cholesterol and obesity and heart problems and things like that. So she thought it meant, she wasn't sure, she said, whether it means overeating once or you and die or you're constantly overeating. Probably. I don't know. Then eating something indigestible. Okay. Another one that she says we do a lot.
Eating without having
the previous meal, yeah, okay. And she said, this idea doesn't mean right away we die, because I certainly would have died a long time ago, because I've been eating, it's just developing really bad eating habits. And that can endanger and cause death. Failure to expel undigested food, even Geshe Zopa didn't go more into detail about that. Intestinal obstructions, twisted bowels, and at that time they didn't have sophisticated medical technology, so if you had that, you were pretty much done. Now we have some medical technology that can treat some of these things.
Still high risk.
Still high risk, because once you start taking apart the bowels, you're starting to take apart a serious part of your body. Okay, any other ones that you can think of?
Not taking medicine.
Untimely death. Yeah. Where there is negative karma. So not only do we have the lifespan karma, we've got the merit karma, we've got this dangerous karma, which includes negative karma from previous lives, and it ripens in an untimely way. So we've got yet this other part of our karmic array that may happen, despite the fact that we're living a wonderful life. We have all of our requisites, we're happy, and I have a little story about that in just a moment. Not relying on specific medicine, so refusing to take our medicine, and Geshe Sopa says mixing medicines that you shouldn't be mixing that actually cause some serious danger to your health. Failure to understand accustomed and unaccustomed things, so usual things that you do and then you start doing something that you don't have the capacity for, you don't have the training for, skill or stamina, like doing the Iron Man when you've just been used to walking around the block. Going rock climbing without any training because your friend went ahead and gave you a double dare. This is failure to understand what your capacity is and what's appropriate and not appropriate for you to do. Then engaging in sexual intercourse, you lose, I guess, a lot of your vitality is diminished, and that may endanger
sex,
other parts.
Too much sex.
Whatever that means. Okay, so here are different causes of death. And then when you think about the people in your life and you think about how they've died and what were the extenuating circumstances. Maybe they just died from old age, but then, of course, we've got disease. People who have had a lot of misfortune, either financial misfortune. They've had some kinds of fatalities in their life. They have had just a lot of difficulties, and that we look at all of this as in play at any given time. All of this stuff is kind of going on, so we're going through our life with all of what looks like a really cool life, and then there's all these little cooperative conditions that might be just needing to be nourished. And I wanted to share with you something that is a perfect example of number eight, untimely death when a negative karma ripens during the middle of a very full, wonderful life. And this happened just a few weeks ago to an acquaintance of ours' husband. He was coming home from work. He was in his 40s. He was 20 minutes from his home. It was around Halloween or so. And I don't know if they know the details yet or not. I haven't been tracking the story, but he evidently pissed somebody off quite a bit in his driving. The person followed him home to his driveway, kidnapped him, forced him to reveal his financial numbers, like on an ATM, took him to a deserted area, killed him, emptied his account, and torched his car. And this is a man who was in the full prime of his life with a lovely family, successful, healthy, loved by many, many people. And that one moment where he must have done something, and there was that karmic seed that who knows what had been sitting in there, that man got enraged and went for him and didn't stop until he took his life. It was road rage in that moment. And here's a negative seed in the middle of a beautiful lifespan with plenty of merit, plenty of requisites, minding his own business, being a good human being, and boom. So we can set up our plans for how we're going to die, and then something like this happens. So that's the untimely death that can be caused by negative karma from a previous life ripening. And so, as Venerable says, I will set my plans for death out, but that's not what is going to happen. And as we've had in our chant, Parting from the Four Clingings, we waste our entire lives in preparations, while in preparations we all die. Even in death, there is no end to preparations, for we begin preparations for the next life, which really shows that how unstable this life is and how continually surprised we are when somebody dies, when something happens. We really don't understand that the time of death is uncertain, and there's all this, what is it, tied by the strong bonds of karma that are so hard to undo. I mean, we don't even know what's in there. Okay, the next section is mind at death. So we've got a number of kinds of minds that we can have at death, depending on how we've taken care of our minds during our life. We can have either virtue or non-virtue equally, that we can remember on our own or remembered by others. Those that we have become so accustomed to and have done repeatedly in the past, since we're such creatures of habit, as the kinds of thoughts that we have had in the past come naturally at the time of death. I mean, they're just there. So it's really important to pay attention to what we are, you know, what we put our mind on, what we set our attention on during our life. So Venerable then goes into, because what happens when at the time of death, if you have non-virtuous karma and virtuous karma is equal at the time when you're dying, what's going to happen is the heaviest of those two will ripen. It could be a very profound virtuous karma. It could be a profound negative karma. Being equal then, as you're nearing death, then it is the one that is the most, the one that was done nearest to death. So it was something that you did maybe a week before you died. Then that comes up to ripen. Both non-virtue and virtuous, if both of those are equal at the time of death, then the one that's most habituated. So look at all the look at all the factors that have to be involved as you're dying. And then if it being equal to the most habituated, then there's going to be a karma from another previous life is going to be thrown into the mix. So you've got all this stuff going on at the time of death. And without having a mind that's well-trained, it's going to be pretty much like having a poker game at the time of death. So Venerable then goes on to one of her few little admonishments in here. She says, every time we whine about something or complain, we're putting imprints in our minds. Even those little things like, I don't like this, how come they're doing it that way when I ask them to do it this way? These are all the kind of thoughts that become familiar, the kind of little snickerings, the little afflictive states of mind, dissatisfaction, attachment, frustration. These are the kind of things that we're planting in our minds that may ripen at the time of death. So she says it's very important to know what's going on in our minds at all times. And if we're ruminating with a negative mental state of mind, as Venerable Chinni said today, we kept those early, I do not want to be thinking like this. I want to be thinking differently. I want to be thinking with a virtuous state of mind and turn it. Because at the time of death, we can't turn it. It's going to be there. So non-virtue and virtuous states of mind, the karmas of equal weight, they can go either way. So the first one that arises, that's the one our mind is going to totally hone in on. Let's see. So tiny things, fixated. She says, don't fixate, you know. Let go of the little things. Let go of the trivial ruminating. You know, don't worry about that. For those of us who can cultivate virtue, and it rises at the time of death, they say that it's like passing from dark to light. As we die in this state, beautiful, pleasant images arise, because during the death process there are many appearances that can be either pleasant or unpleasant, scary or delightful, like dreams, some ripening of some negative karma or some virtuous whatever. So the person familiar with the virtue at the time of death will die very peacefully with no pain, because their bodies are, just don't experience that kind of agony. We've cultivated a lot of non-virtue at the time of death, totally different experience. Our minds can be totally fixated on that anger, on that fear, on that animosity, on that jealousy, pride, craving. And that we're gonna start seeing signs that this is gonna be a pretty scary trip. It's gonna be like getting caught in a nightmare that you can't stop. Frightening images will appear, and that we will seem to pass from light to darkness. We'll have a lot of physical pain. They say that your hair will stand on end, your hands and your feet will shake, you're gonna wet your pants, and your eyes are gonna, I mean, it's just terrifying just to to know. I've not ever seen anybody die, but I would not want to be in that state when I die. So one of the things that I did experience, which I found helpful, even though I haven't seen a human being die, is that when the two founding kitties at the Abbey died here about 7-8 years ago, Achal and Manju, they were dying. And when that time, when they were moving into that, the dissolutions of the body, I'm not sure where they were, but they were starting to try to get out of their beds. They were crying, they were growling, they were really panicked. And what Venerable would keep saying to them is, it's okay, Achi, it's just an appearance to the mind. Don't be afraid, it's just an appearance to the mind. So as animals, maybe there was some negative karma that was ripening, so they were having some very scary appearances coming to their minds. She kept saying that over and over again, Manju, just an appearance to the mind, sweetie, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. So that's what that happens, is that these things are showing up, and we have a Dharma friend who can remind us, but by then, who knows if we even have the ability to hear them at that point. Okay. Let's see where we are. Oh yeah, just cruising along that way. Okay. The other thing that ends up being quite a difficulty when we're dying is that our discrimination becomes really unclear. And what we start going for is that beings are really attached to the self, which we have long been familiar with. We can't think clearly, we have difficulty discerning things, but we know very clearly that we're attached to this self, who we think we are. We don't want to lose it. Our entire identity that we have sort of fabricated through the course of our life, whether it's been our place of origin, our nationality, our gender, our livelihood, our hobbies, our talents, our skills, we have fabricated and conjured up conceptually this huge identity. And at the time of death, we're losing everything. All of that is going to go away. And as we go through this process of dying, as to who we think we are, the elements of the body are losing strength and they can't support this gross consciousness that can grab onto these identities, that there is a feeling that I'm ceasing to exist. This is how strong the grasping itself is at the time of death. I'm becoming non-existent. And you don't have any mental energy to counteract that or discern or say, wait a minute, that's not true. There is no self here. Unless you're a highly realized being, you're just craving and clinging onto the self that seems to be falling away. And it's the scariest, most fearful thing, that I am ceasing to exist. So what do? We grasp. We crave for another body. I don't want to separate from this body, but if I'm going to have to, I want another one, and I hold on to dear life. And it's that grasping itself that brings us into the bardo. And as ordinary beings who have a lot of this grasping at death, stream enterers and once returners have this attachment to the self. They have realized emptiness directly, but they also have the capacity to investigate with wisdom. They reject it and do not assent to it. Because they have this understanding of emptiness, they are able to recognize the attachment to the self, apply the meditation on emptiness to it, and release it. As the same way as a powerful person dominates a weak person, their wisdom dominates ignorance. So before they've moved into that very subtle consciousness, they actually have this capacity to reject that attachment to the self as they're going through the dying process. The attachment to self doesn't arise in non-returners. And as far as bodhisattvas, the attachment to self happens through the path of accumulation and preparation, but by the path of seeing, most bodhisattvas pretty much can control the rebirth, so they kind of know what's going on. So as we're...
Can I ask, does he say specifically how much, can you imagine how much the inferential realization, how much impact that would have?
Well, he doesn't. It says realized emptiness directly.
Yeah, I know.
But it does. He didn't say, Geshe Zobe didn't say anything about how important the inferential understanding would help at the time of death, except that it would hopefully create a very strong virtuous state of mind, so we're not going to have any kind of negative karma ripening. Yeah, he didn't get into that. At least I didn't see it in here. Okay. And then as we go through this, as the body finally just sort of, you know, fades away, the elements dissolve, the mind gets subtler and subtler and subtler, and at the time of death, the mind is pretty much in a neutral state. You're not hearing anything, your faculties have all absorbed, your heart has stopped, you don't remember anything, and you can't hear anything. So once again, this is just to get very, very aware of the process of what cyclic existence brings for us until we can realize and liberate ourselves from it. And then quickly just to go through that, at the time of death, the consciousness leaves the body in different ways. It's very, 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 very subtle mind. For those who cultivated non-virtue, the heat of the body comes down from the upper parts, down and comes out through the heart chakra. For someone who has cultivated virtue, it comes up from the lower parts of the body and then goes out through the heart chakra. And this is the place, through the heart chakra is where our next rebirth, where the consciousness enters the fertilized ovum, that becomes the body's heart. So when our subtle consciousness meets the ovum and the sperm, that becomes the heart chakra. And then from there, the cells divide, multiply, and that's how the body grows from that very subtle place. That's all I wanted to say about that. So the next outline, how to reach the intermediate state after death. The Pali Sutras say that at the last moment of consciousness of this life, you go into the very next moment of the next life. There are some that do talk about the intermediate state, but for the most part, they say one moment of consciousness in this life, the next moment into the very next life, unlike the Mahayana that says we have this intermediate state. As soon as the consciousness leaves the body, you're in the bardo, which is contingent upon the attachment to the body and then throwing karma, whether it's virtuous or non-virtuous. So those are the two things that are contingent on reaching the intermediate state. This grasping, I need another body, then also whatever throwing karma, virtuous or non-virtuous, sets us in that direction as well. And when we get into this intermediate state, there's all sorts of incredible things that we can do. I don't want to get into too much of that because it gets a little bit like too much magical thinking, but we have some supernormal powers. We can wish something and be there. We can fly around. We have these very subtle mental bodies that are bodies that look similar to the body that we're going to have the next time, in our next rebirth. When I got to this part of talking about all of these powers that a bardo body has, I said, well, what happens if you're going to be, your negative karma is putting you into a slug rebirth or a cat rebirth? Do they have supernormal powers?
We have no control over them.
I mean...
Right, I mean, so to call them supernormal powers is a little bit elevating.
Well, that's what...
Yeah, I mean, it follows that way, but it's not like it's a controlled mind that says, oh, I'd like to go spend some time in China. It's like you have the thought and you're just like...
Like right there, right, you're whipped around, right. But you can so also do like things cool that you can't do with the body.
It's terrifying.
But what I'm saying is that when you do have another body besides a human body, does that being have the same experience of being able to do, but gets thrown around in a same tumultuous way?
Yeah.
Same tumultuous way.
Yeah. And you're attracted wherever that
thought
craving takes
you. Yeah. Going here and there just with the thought, very excited about different things. All this stuff doesn't matter. We're being thrown around. We have no control. So it's a really, you know, even with a virtuous mind, you're still under the control of ignorance. Okay, so there's all different versions of what happens. How many, Vasubandhu says that you have a body you gain while in the bardo will be the one that you will take in a realm you will be reborn in. There's no variations. A sangha says, well, after 7 days, if the conditions don't come together, you can have a mini death, and at that time the karma can change, which is where it becomes valuable for others to make charity of your possessions, to make prayers during this time, which may cause some different karma to ripen, so the next rebirth can be different than the original karma. So there's a lot going on if indeed what a sangha says is true. So there's two variations on what happens as far as how our rebirths are thresholds. So far, so good, folks. Sobering, but helpful. And then how, before we get into the measure of having produced the thought of renunciation, which is, we're going to talk a lot about what this hopefully will generate in us, is that when we leave the intermediate stage, we immediately take rebirth. The sperm and the ovum unite, the subtle consciousness enters, and the four great elements, solidity, moisture, movement, and heat, in their subtle aspect give rise to very subtle sense faculties, and that becomes the heart chakra. And that's where basically life begins at that moment. And that's all I'm going to say about that. So why is this taught in the Lam Rim Chenmo, Venerable says? Because we need to think about these things. What it would be like at the time of death, in the intermediate state, how confusing it's going to be, how many times we've been through it, and do we want to be going through this again and again? And this is where, when we look at this and we contemplate this whole thread from that fundamental ignorance that misperceives how we exist and all that happens as a result of that, to look at that thread and say, do we really want to continue to be spinning this thread over and over and over again? And so hopefully, when we do this and we do these meditations over and over again, that we then start to say, well, maybe I better, to get a better sense of what this determination to be free is really about. It's not going to be full renunciation, but hopefully, Venerable says, the teachings have influenced our minds towards thinking about renunciation. And she says that if, after these teachings, we don't get a little bit of determination generated in her mind, she says two things. First, she says that the teacher, there's something wrong with the teacher. And she said, and since the Buddha is the teacher, we can take that one out of the equation. The other one, which is more likely, is that we haven't been thinking of the meaning of the teachings. We've just put them into our notebooks, and then we've closed the laptop down, and we've just forgotten about it. She says, chances are, that's why we don't have a little bit more juice around the possibility of getting out of cyclic existence, liberating ourselves, is because we're not doing the internal work to really get what this situation is really about. We have been in cyclic existence for so long that we really have to make a very strong effort to recognize its defects and to look at them in terms of our own life. And she reminds us that renouncing samsara is not renouncing happiness, but it's renouncing dukkha. One part of renunciation is we're giving up samsara, and the other part is making a strong aspiration for liberation. There are two motivations that come together with the determination to be free. The Gomchen says we have to feel really repulsed by samsara and truly deeply attracted to this state of liberation. It's almost like wishing to escape a house fire. You are fighting for your life. That's what that whole line of, you know, unceasingly, day and night, unceasingly, the mind aspiring for liberation. It's almost like we've realized that we're in a house that's on fire and that we've got to get out. That's the kind of feeling that we need to generate towards cyclic existence. That, and then this is the motivation that is shared by intermediate beings. So we're in the middle scope. We don't become, and we don't cultivate the mind of an intermediate being, but we share their motivation because that's part of the process. Shared because at the get-go, we have bodhicitta as our motivation, and we want to become a Buddha. But we do practice the path that is shared with the intermediate beings who do this specifically for liberation of oneself. So Venerable says we sometimes get confused about this, that if we're going to want to cultivate this determination to be free and liberate ourselves, doesn't that put us, sort of throw us into the here and the fundamental vehicle? And she says, as long as you keep bodhicitta in your mind and your long-term goal is to aspire to Buddhahood, you're not going to have any concern about that. But, she says, without renunciation, we can't generate great compassion. All right, so this was another whole piece that I that was very helpful, is that we need to practice and generate this motivation to free ourselves from cyclic existence, because without that we cannot generate the great compassion that's going to continue to move us along into the advanced level practice. So without renunciation, no great compassion. That was a really important connection for me. You can't go forward to develop great compassion, or you can't practice the advanced level, because renunciation is really important. We need to look at all the defects of cyclic existence, not like as a head trip, but to see it as in a personal experience in our life, looking at our life and saying, is this true? Is this how cyclic existence, how I experience it in my life? She says, you can't do this as an intellectual exercise. And then what happens when we're deeply getting this strong determination to be free, and then we look at others and see that they're going through the same experience, to know that they're experiencing the 6 dukkhas, the 8 dukkhas of being human beings, the 3 types of dukkha, all these different types of dissatisfaction, then our heart opens to say, my goodness, you know, I've got some tools. I want to liberate myself, but there isn't anybody in this cycle of existence that isn't struggling with the same issues. And so this is where I went to one of Venerable's teachings that she gave on renunciation many, many years ago. And she said, it's really helpful to see people as just karmic bubbles. So when we're trying to generate this determination to be free, and we turn and look at the rest of the world and we see the struggles, we see the sufferings of others, she says, just an appearance that was created by karma that lasts for a little while and then is gone. The subtle continuity of mind changing moment by moment, propelled by these strong waves of karma to take a body that is composed of material, also changing moment by moment. So we look at people as these karmic bubbles, these appearances, and how they're trapped in these appearances, how they're trapped in this karma, that we can really start growing this great compassion. Here's this person who looks so real, who looks so happy, looks like they have this particular personality, but it's just an appearance. It's just an appearance due to their karma. They're not going to be alive forever in one moment, just like this man that's an acquaintance of ours. Boom, gone. They're caught by their own afflictive emotions, their own karma. They're going to get swept away into their next life, into their next experience. And what can I do? I can't do anything. There isn't some kind of permanent, inherently existent personality that I can keep them with me, that I can hold on to them, that I can help them. I can't control anything. I can't control my own rebirth, much control the kind of suffering that they're experiencing. So when she said, well, we can look at people having these kind of karmic appearances. They're not so solid, but they're trapped in these appearances, this karma, that then we can really have this beautiful compassion that starts to rise in us, because we can see that they're subject to all the defects of cyclic existence, just like us. We see how much misery they have because they're bound by their own self-centered thought. They're bound by their own grasping, their own ignorance, grasping at who they think they are, which doesn't even exist. That they're all karmic appearances. All the people that we think are wonderful, that we love, are in the same dire situation as we are. So she said, this is so helpful. Just loosens up our concept, loosens up our attachment to them, our personal distress around them, and that we can really grow this compassion because we see them trapped, but they're just appearances to the mind. And then she, I'm trying to be succinct here, folks. Impermanent phenomena. Seeing other people like this really helps our compassion because we see them much more accurately for what they are. That they are, and when we bring them into our meditation, when we see the dissatisfactory, relentlessly disappointing situation that they're in, then we can see how kind they've been, how they're worthy of our love, that we wish them to be free from all of this as much as we do. But first we have to really cultivate this wish to free ourselves first. This whole idea of having compassion for ourselves first is a crucial piece, because we can't really extend that. We can't extend it beyond ourselves unless we've got that compassion that strongly wishes us to be free from this cycle. And Venerable says we have to be really careful that we don't see compassion for ourselves kind of as this self-indulgent, we buy ourselves presents, we do all these kind of worldly things under the guise of being kind and loving ourselves. If we want to be kind to ourselves, we want to be compassionate to ourselves, free ourselves from this cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death. It's not about buying a new sofa, it's not about buying a new computer, it's about freeing ourselves if we really want to give ourselves happiness, we really want to be fulfilled. He keeps describing over and over again how it's important to be able to discern what truly caring for ourselves is about. And right now, she says, our renunciation is full of effort and not a lot of joy. I get up in the morning, oh, I gotta go to the hall. I'm so tired. Oh, I guess I gotta do my water bowls. Oh my God, purification practice. It's so hard. Every day, 35 Buddhas over and over again. This is the kind of effort we're working on right now. So we need to up that up a little bit. And she says by repeatedly habituating ourselves to looking at how to see the defects of cyclic existence, to bring some energy into our practice, to see this situation that we're in. She said it'll bring some joy, bring some energy into our practice. And she says that renunciation is no small spiritual realization. And when you have it, she says, you get incredible energy behind your practice, incredible focus behind your practice. Then people who criticize you, people who praise you, love you, hate you, you don't really care about what they think. You're so focused, you're so energized by getting yourself out of this cycle of samsara that you pretty much let people be. It's because you're really clear about what meaning you have in your life and what you're going to do. The stock market goes up, the stock market goes down, somebody takes advantage of you, somebody doesn't take advantage of you, somebody scratches your car, somebody doesn't scratch your car, you don't care. She says, gosh, wouldn't that be nice to just have our minds so focused and prioritized on what's so meaningful that the little disappointments of samsara, they're just little blips on the screen. They're not dramas, they're not reactions, they're not over-the-top dramas. They're just like, oh, what do you expect? It's samsara. Because we've cared about something that's more important, getting out of this whole trip together. So instead of trying to decorate our prison cell, we did this one winter, we make our prison cell prettier. We go through the headache of decorating it with crepe paper, Christmas lights, Christmas tree, tinsel, little lights, pretty pictures on the wall, some nice essential oils, soft bed. She says we're still in prison. No matter what we do, we tweak samsara, so let's just be done with it. So she just, you know, chides us along the way, saying we all have shortcuts in samsara to get ahead. We want some special favors, we want some special sales, we want some special deals, some special treatment. Oh, come on, Buddha, can't you do a little bit of this work for me? It's just too hard. But she says, you know, the path to liberation, there are no shortcuts. We have to do all the work ourselves, which on some level you can kind of cringe at that, or you can feel really empowered by it, you know, to realize that I'm the producer and the creator of this show, and whatever's coming up in my life, I'm the one who's basically created the causes for this. You know, that can be an extremely energizing, empowering, vitalizing, clarifying, prioritizing thing. Prioritizing, you know what I mean. Because there's no way to get out of it except by, you know, our own efforts and the kindness and the wisdom of our teachers, thank goodness, and the support of our Dharma friends, but it's pretty much on our plate. And so she says, you know, for the people in the West, we don't like this meditation. We don't want to think about all the problems that are, you know, we're supposed to look at, all the defects of cyclic existence, how much unhappiness and boredom and restlessness. We don't even want to look at that stuff. We want to go right to bodhicitta. We want to go right to the higher trainings. We want to go right to the meditations on emptiness. But no renunciation, no great compassion. No renunciation, no bodhicitta. So if you're wondering why, you know, your compassion, your bodhicitta aren't growing, it's because we haven't generated the determination to be free to the level and the depth that it needs to be. We want to bypass it. Go directly. Go past. Go. Don't, you know, collect the $200 and not do any of the work. I don't want to look at the 10 non-virtues. I don't want to look at death. She says, it's so interesting, Dharma, in the West. We're just kind of shortcuts. Okay, so the last piece here is just eliminating the false ideas about renunciation. So it is said, I forget where this was, it was maybe in the Laman Chenmo, is wandering in samsara under the influence of afflictions and karma is to be feared by bodhisattvas. But taking rebirth under the influence of compassion and prayer, it is said they should be delighted in. So a question with renunciation is our aspiration for liberation. If bodhisattvas generate that motivation, aren't they falling into the here and solitary realizer vehicle? Because that's what they're aiming for. If as a bodhisattva, aren't you becoming a here or a solitary realizer when you generate this strong determination to be free? On one hand, if you don't generate it, how are you going to get yourself out of samsara? How are you going to generate compassion? But if you do, doesn't that set you on the path to liberation for yourself alone? It sounds weird, that's what she says, but she explains it's not weird at all. Well, she says, as long as we've heard about bodhicitta and we have that in our mind, don't stop with liberation for oneself, but go on to become a bodhisattva again and again to bring those teachings into our mind to really understand clearly that that is our motivation. We will never have to worry. If we keep that in our mind as our fundamental motivation, we won't fall into the path of the here and solitary realizers. And that there's a special way that bodhisattvas understand renunciation. Okay, so if we're going on in that track, this is one of the ways to look at it. They want to be free of cyclic existence, of taking rebirth with the five aggregates under the influence of afflictions and karma, but they don't want to be free of rebirth taken under the influence of compassion, the great resolve. They will do that since every living being, until every living being is free from cyclic existence. They have no problem taking rebirth with the motivation of great compassion and the great resolve. Bodhisattvas from the path of seeing upward take rebirth in cyclic existence, but not under the control of afflictions and karma. Instead, under the influence of this incredible compassion and prayers, they're not under the influence of ignorance, although it's not out of their minds completely until they reach that eighth bhumi. They're not swayed by it. It's so weak in their minds that they don't even have to consider it. They also have spontaneous bodhicitta. They've got spontaneous compassion. And so by the sheer force of that great resolve and that great compassion, that renunciation, they have no problem. There's no detour. There's no going on to just the liberation for themselves. And they have amazing joyous effort. They have such an incredible happy mind despite the fact that they take rebirth in this world of suffering, this world of dissatisfaction. Their minds are so happy, their minds are so filled with joy, and they're so focused, undeterred by this great compassion and this bodhicitta motivation. So Venerable says, what we're trying to do with renunciation is to see the false, to give us some energy to change the situation. That this is actually one of the most difficult things for us to see in our practice. She said, at some level, we've got to have some renunciation, or else we wouldn't be here. Okay, being at the Abbey, she says, we wouldn't be living here if at some level we didn't say, yes, I want to get out of cyclic existence. That got us here. But then if we look at it day to day when we wake up in the morning, what is our first thought? Is our first thought, I want to get out of cyclic existence, or is it, where is my tea? Or, you know, 15 more minutes. I want other sentient beings to also get out of cyclic existence, or is it, how can I have my pleasure today? So we've gotten this far. We've got ourselves into some of the most conducive circumstances for developing renunciation. But now what are we doing when we first wake up in the morning? She says, check and see, where's your mind? So for the last thing here, I just want to do this last little sort of meditation before we end this. It was a little homework assignment, but I wanted to do it as a meditation. So let's do this little, she's got a few questions here. And it's going to be kind of a self-evaluation on what our minds, she said, let's watch our thoughts. She's got some questions here, so let's do this. And then we'll finish up with this little assignment. And it's just to do a little research while we're sitting here looking at our minds and see what goes on. Make this very personal. Make it your life experience on how you experience your day. And be very, very honest and transparent and kind to yourself. So the first question she asks us is, how many of my thoughts are concerned with renunciation and bodhicitta during the course of the day? We'll just maybe run through today. No judgment, no condescension. Just take a note. And then how many of your thoughts today were, how can I have pleasure? Once again, just note them. And then how many thoughts today were, how can I avoid doing unpleasant things today? How can I avoid suffering? Unpleasantness. And then I would add probably a final one is to maybe make a commitment to ourselves that maybe at the end of the day for maybe the next week or so, we ask these three questions of ourselves. How many of my thoughts were concerned with renunciation and bodhicitta? How many of them, or how can I have pleasure? And how can I avoid doing unpleasant things today? And see, by taking this personal inventory at the end of the day, to see if we can commit to changing the balance so that renunciation and bodhicitta maybe become a little bit more conscious in the course of our day, if that is indeed the one that you weren't thinking. Comments or questions before we dedicate? Helpful, scary, sobering, boring, uncomfortable, all of the above.
Important.
All except boring.
Okay.
Most exciting topic. Most exciting topic.
You think so? Good thing is to have a calendar that puts your general lifespan, let's say, for your gender, your culture, whatever you are, and then to just keep ticking them off. It would probably add some energy, I would think, to your practice. Not including the exhaustion of merit or the dangerous circumstances. That's just if your karmic lifespan follows course, and that you brought in a nice long one, for sure. That might add some energy to your practice. But important, not boring, can't have any indifference when you think about this. So let's really dedicate our efforts to generating some deeper understanding of the determination to be free, and to really look at the meditations and the commentaries on the middle scope. It's just fabulous up to this part. Yes?
I have a couple of comments from folks online.
Okay.
First one is, thank you for the special teaching. Some of these we have been studying in SAFE course 2. So this was especially helpful to hear again. And then another person says, thank you, and also thank you for the review and the questions. Every time this is more and more sobering, knowing that death can literally come at any moment. I can see how each moment really matters.
It's a good conclusion to draw. All right. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious body, mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chinrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. Peerless Supreme Spiritual Leader, Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Motherly Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With a clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Tupten, the Able One's teachings, you bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of Chidren, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in the glory of eternal bliss. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, flourish.